Hi, this is Nancy Clare. Welcome to episode 36 of Speaking of Mysteries. This week's guest is Sophie Hanna, whose eighth Zeller and Waterhouse mystery, The Carrier, has just been published in the United States. Sophie Hanna is a self-described structure freak, as the tightness of The Carrier's plot demonstrates. The story delves deep into the harm, from psychological to physical, that individuals can do to each other, and how poetry can illuminate and obfuscate communication. Here's Sophie Hanna. Hello, and welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. I'm delighted that today's guest is Sophie Hanna, whose The Carrier has just been released in the United States. And my first question is, The Carrier is a bit of an unusual story, and I was wondering if there was anything in particular, something reported in the news, for example, that inspired this story?
Well, nothing that was reported in the news, but several things in real life inspired it. The first was that the beginning of the book, the scene in the airport where Gabby is travelling back from a business trip and gets accosted by a strange, hysterical woman, that actually happened to me. Almost exactly that. So the plane was delayed. We were all sent to a hotel in Germany to fly back the next day. And when we arrived at the hotel, the receptionist said, "I'm terribly sorry, we weren't expecting a plane load full of Brits. We haven't got enough rooms for you, so anyone travelling alone will have to share with a stranger." And this young woman immediately sort of grabbed me and said, "You're sharing with me." And I was sort of too scared to say, "Who are you? You seem a bit strange." And then a few seconds later, she burst into tears and said, "I'm having a panic attack. Please look after me." Now, in real life, it was just a very annoying and inconvenient experience because she was in a complete state and spent the whole night sort of giving me the runaround, saying she was hungry and she didn't have any money and she was sort of having various kinds of emotional meltdowns. And we had to share a room, and when we got up to the room, there was only one bed in it, and I just thought, oh no, I'm basically going to have to share a small double bed with a hysterical stranger. And so it just seemed like such a good opening to a psychological thriller, although I didn't enjoy it when it was actually happening to me. That was one of the starting points. Another of the starting points was that I was fascinated by relationships, and in particular long marriages, where people want to stay in the marriage, but at the same time they're not at all happy. And that question of why do so many people want to stay in marriages that make them deeply miserable? And so Tim, the man who's confessed to murder in the book, who's confessed to murdering his wife, he is the love of Gabby's life, and she could never understand why he didn't want to leave his wife and go off with her, because he was in love with her, but he seemed absolutely determined to stay with this wife who made him deeply miserable and treated him terribly badly. And at the time the airport experience happened to me, I also had a very close friend who was in a marriage exactly like that. He was very, very keen to preserve this marriage, to stay in the marriage, and yet it made him miserable and scared on an almost daily basis. And I just thought, you know, I was just became very interested psychologically in that phenomenon.
Well, poetry plays a key role in the story as both a vehicle of enlightenment and one of obfuscation. Yes. I know that you are a poet. And did that make it easier or harder to build poetry into the body of the story?
It certainly wasn't hard to build it in. I mean, to a certain extent, a lot of what ends up in my books, I don't quite know consciously why I put it in. It just occurs to me and I know it belongs in there. So I just sort of knew fairly early on. Because, I mean, The Carrier, as well as being a hopefully gripping murder mystery, is also a love story. It's the story of Gabby's relationship with Tim. And I just sort of knew, as if by magic, fairly early on, that poetry would be a key sort of thing that they, a key sort of love that they had in common, a way of communicating with one another that they used. And of course, Tim is a very ambiguous and sort of elusive character. So for him, he's doing precisely what you say, exactly. He's using poetry to communicate, but also to put up barriers.
He does a good job of that. And I also was interested in the library where they met, specifically the poetry library. That struck me as, I don't know if there is such a place, but it struck me as this sort of magical kingdom, this magical realm.
Yeah, well, actually, there are specialist poetry libraries in England, and there are also private subscription libraries, which you can only use if you're a member, and they also operate sort of like members' dining clubs. And my first ever job when I left university was as a secretary in a private subscription library, and the one in the Carrier is based on the one I worked at.
I mean, it sounds like a wonderful place to go.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, it's like an old gentleman's club, you know, with leather chairs and stained glass windows and amazing architecture. That was certainly what the one I worked in was like.
Where you're surrounded by poetry and you can commune. You can commune with the books and commune with each other. I thought that was just a wonderful center for them to spin out from.
Oh, right. Thank you.
Well, what do you think poetry and thrillers have in common? Which informs the other more? Which would carry the most weight? Is there more mystery in poetry or more poetry in mystery?
I think probably equal amounts of both. But, I mean, I do think they have a very important thing in common, and I suspect it's this very important thing they have in common that makes me attracted to both genres. And that is that in a good crime novel and in a good poem, structure and form is absolutely crucial. So in a literary novel, you know, depending on what kind of novel it was, maybe structure wouldn't be that important. But in a metrical rhyming poem with a sort of complex verse structure, and in a complex multi-layered plot crime novel, everything has to be in exactly the right position in relation to everything else. So, you know, if you have a sonnet and the first 12 lines are brilliant and the last two lines are sort of flabby and inert, then that will bring down the whole structure of the poem. And similarly, if you have a crime novel with a brilliant twist revealed at the end, that twist is only going to work if you've underpinned it all the way along with, you know, planting this bit of information in chapter 3 and that bit in chapter 11, so that when the big twist at the end happens, you think, oh, yeah, they did sort of mention it then, but I just didn't see it. So, you know, if you don't do that underpinning, then the twist has no impact. So I think, you know, because I'm a structure freak, I'm attracted to formal rhyming poetry and intricately plotted mystery fiction.
The two sort of go hand in hand.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
In addition to the mystery in the book, which is an incredibly clever locked room mystery, there are a lot of mind games going on, and I was dying to know the solution, but also at the same time, I never wanted the semantic gymnastics and the machinations between the characters to end.
That's one of the nicest things you could possibly have said about the book.
Was this a fun book to write? I know that the beginning wasn't fun. I know that the initial launch of being stuck in a German airport with a crazy woman was not maybe the best way to start it. But other than that, was this a fun book to write?
It was. I mean, all my books are fun to write once I get over the fear of them. So every time I start writing, I'm always scared that, you know, maybe this will be the book that won't quite work out and that I'll have to abandon. But, yeah, once I got into it, it was huge fun to write. I would say that it was probably also the most challenging book I've written so far. It was very, very hard to get exactly right because there's quite a lot going on. You know, there's the plot, but there's also there's several different layers and all the characterization. And in some ways, it's quite a literary crime novel. You know, it's a novel as well as a mystery. It was quite important to me to get everything exactly right. But it's also one of the books of mine that I'm happiest with as well.
Well, I think you bring up an interesting point, and one that I've discussed with other writers that I've spoken to on the podcast, and that's this idea of literary thriller. And You know, I think that the idea of genre fiction, my approach to it, and many of the writers' approach to it that I've spoken to, is that it's almost an artificial rubric now. It doesn't really mean anything. I mean, when you have Man Booker Prize winners writing and here in the States Pulitzer Prize winning fiction authors writing mysteries, it's a plot structure in the literary. Nick Harkaway said it is a organizational principle. That's what he called the idea of dividing books into genre.
Right.
And, you know,
But what did he mean?
Well, he meant that it's just like that's the shelf that they would put it on.
Yeah, I think, I mean, for me, genre categories are quite useful in some ways, I think. I mean, what a category definition tells me is what the book's sort of priorities are. So, I mean, obviously there are many, many cases that don't fit the template, but I still think that doesn't necessarily mean that if we threw out these terms altogether, we'd be better off. Because I do think, you know, when someone says, I've just read a brilliant commercial thriller, straight down the line, mass market commercial thriller, what that says to me is that book places storytelling absolutely front and centre. That is the main priority. If somebody says they've read a literary novel, not even a literary thriller, but a literary novel, then I will think to myself, okay, that's probably a book in which the story is not very much the main thing. There could be lots of things about that book that are the main thing. It could be the language, it could be the themes, the atmosphere, the setting. I think commercial mass market fiction as a category is basically like holding up a sign for readers saying, if you want a gripping story over and above everything else, these are the books for you. Do you see, does that make sense?
Yes, if you want a page turner, makes absolute sense. I guess the point I was trying to make was that a book should not be dismissed out of hand because it's in a category.
Oh, it certainly shouldn't be dismissed. I mean, I get very cross with people who say that Agatha Christie, who's my favourite crime writer, is not a properly good writer because she just writes gripping plots. She's seen very much as a sort of disposable commercial crime writer because her stories are so gripping. But she's also a brilliant writer, and I reckon I could fight and win anyone who says she isn't. So I think it's silly to dismiss books which have sort of commercial gripping stories as their main priority. It's silly to dismiss them and think they're not necessarily well written, but I'm just saying I don't think it's silly to have categories, because as a reader I often fancy a particular kind of book. So, you know, sometimes I particularly fancy a really straight down the line mass market commercial thriller, and I'm glad that I can go to a section of the bookshop where I can find those things. So if all fiction were just in a general fiction section, I mean, obviously, I'd manage, you know. I wouldn't sort of stand there going, oh, I don't know what to read anymore. But I do think it can be helpful for readers. And also for writers, you know, I would always call myself a crime writer, a crime novelist, rather than just a novelist. I'm definitely not a writer of fiction. I'm a writer of crime fiction, particularly. And what I mean by that is not that my books are any less good or more disposable, because I very much hope they aren't. But what I mean by that is that when readers are reading my books, I imagine and hope that their main sort of driving motivation will be solving the mystery. That's what I'm giving them, you know. Hopefully a brilliantly well-written and, you know, full of interesting characters mystery, but essentially a mystery. And what I hope that they will feel when they're reading it is that they're desperate to find out what's going on. And I think it's those kind of aims and artistic missions that really tell you what kind of writer someone is. So, for example, I think if there's a novelist who always wants to write books in which a woman finds her perfect true love, then it's absolutely right to describe that person as a romance novelist or a romantic novelist. And if another writer wants to write about someone, you know, constantly having, you know, very exciting sexual encounters, then that's erotic fiction. So, you know, I'm just saying, I think these labels are quite useful, as long as they're not used in a reductive way.
Well, you mentioned your characters, and I have to say I love the way your characters talk to each other, and I mean this in the best possible way. They are so querulous, and even those who are on the same side are often at cross purposes. I've heard writers say that characters have the potential to become challenging to work with, and I was wondering if that was ever the case with any of your characters, because they could be difficult people.
Oh, yes. Well, they are. I mean, they're you know, all the people I write about get into all kinds of trouble with each other because, you know, they can be quite spiky characters or quite ruthless or quite devious. But, you know, that's what makes them interesting to write about. I wouldn't like to write about very simple, well-behaved characters because then the book would be much less interesting.
But, they pay a price for their candor, though, I think, don't they?
For their what, sorry?
For their candor. They pay a price for their candor.
Yeah. So, I mean, no one entirely gets away with anything, but at the same time, I hope that my books are projecting the worldview that I want them to project, which is that everybody is slightly flawed and slightly desperate on occasions, and everybody makes mistakes. Everybody does harm to somebody else, whether they mean to or not, at some point. So I hope that my books are kind of non-judgmental in that sense, because what I'm really trying to do is explore the dynamics of how we do harm to one another as human beings, rather than say, here are the good guys, here are the bad guys, because I don't think real life is as simple as that.
No, there's a lot of built-in ambiguity in your characters, and they're on the one side, they can be, especially the two main characters in your book, they can be so cranky. And I think that was what was so wonderful. It's you sort of like, you know, how can these people, the way they talk to each other, it's so wonderful. I mean, I wish I could talk to people like that. I wish I could, I wish I could be that blunt.
Well, actually, I think a lot of the fact that I write like that is because I'm not like that in real life. I'm incredibly, you know, diplomatic and, you know, I'm a real pacifier. If I think someone's feathers are ruffled, I'll always try and smooth it over. So I think when I'm writing, I allow my characters to be far blunter than I would ever be, partly as a kind of outlet for, you know, because it's quite fun, isn't it, to read about people behaving in a way that you daren't behave in but would secretly quite like to.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was like a wish fulfillment fiction. I thought to myself, she said that? That was fantastic.
Yes, well, I think, you know, I'm often in situations where I'd like to say one thing and I say another. And I think, you know, that's partly why I'm a writer, you know, because in writing fiction, I can say whatever I want, whereas in real life, one generally can't.
Right, you get that vicarious comeuppance on the people that...
Yeah, exactly.
That have bothered you. But that also brings up another question for me, and that's what's going to become of the detectives working at the Culver Valley Police Force? And after reading some of the conversations between the colleagues, I was beginning to wonder if they were going to have to solve a murder in their own nick.
No, I don't really like... When I watch police dramas or read police procedurals and one of the police is killed and it suddenly the police become not just the people solving the crime, but, you know, it's one of their own. I never really like that blurring of boundaries as a reader and as a viewer. So I don't think that will ever happen. But to find out what happens next to all the police characters, you only have to wait until the summer when their next adventure is appearing. So my next book after The Carrier that's going to be published in America is called Woman with a Secret, and that is out either July or August, I can't remember which, I think July. And Simon Waterhouse and Charlie Zaylor and all the police team are in that as well. And of course, that's it's a completely new story with a new heroine. And in many ways, it's a standalone novel, but I like to have my cake and eat it. So I try and make it so that each novel is a standalone in the voice of a new heroine, but the police characters are there as they were in the previous books.
Well, you also seem to have a couple of the other things that seem to be coming about to be published. You have a novella, Pictures or Didn't Happen, which is due in February, and a game for All of the Family, which is due in April.
That's in England. So my American publishing schedule is slightly still trying to catch up with the UK publishing schedule. So in America, my next book out is Woman with a Secret. That's already published in England with a different title. In England, it's called The Telling Error.
They just do that. It's, you know, what did Winston Churchill say? You know, separated by a common language.
Yes. Well, my American publisher said that a lot of Americans wouldn't be familiar with the phrase telling error. So we thought, is there anything else we could call it? And the novel begins with a sort of personal ad from a dating website, and the heading of this ad is looking for a woman with a secret. So I just said, well, Americans are always saying they like simple titles. How about Woman with a Secret? And my publisher said, oh, yes, that's very good. So that's what it's going to be called. And it's about a woman who appears to be a very respectable wife and mother on the surface, but secretly she's leading a very dangerous double life online.
Interesting.
Which ends up, well, not ends up, within the first chapter of the book, her secret and dangerous double life leads her to be suspected of the murder of a controversial newspaper columnist.
Well, it gives us something to look forward to, and sounds like a great summer read, too. Do you have plans for another Poirot novel as well?
That's sort of under discussion at the moment, so things are looking quite hopeful. Nothing sort of firmed up yet, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if there were to be another one.
Do you think that this is that you're becoming overloaded? Is it hard? Is that hard to do, to change voices?
Not really. I mean, it's actually quite refreshing and sort of creatively energizing to move from one kind of book to another. So certainly, when I wrote the Poirot novel, the first one, The Monogram Murders, the book I wrote after that, which was, you know, a contemporary psychological thriller again, that I just felt very refreshed coming back to my original genre, having been away briefly. So I think it can be quite good for you.
Sophie Hannah, thank you so much for
You're welcome.
For joining us.
You're welcome. It was lovely to talk to you.
Next week's guest is Michael Cardos, another writer of psychological crime fiction, whose Before He Finds Her is scheduled to be published on February 3rd. Until then, this is Nancy Clare. Thank you for listening to Speaking of Mysteries.